Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for making the world part of your world by tuning into the show every day. We are grateful for your support. This year, the holiday season looks a lot different. Here at The World, we know what it's like to feel out of touch and uncertain about the future. That's why we strive to bring you honest stories that connect you with people around the globe. One thing you can be certain of is that The World team is dedicated to bringing you the coverage you need. Right now, though, the world needs you. Specifically, 578 dedicated listeners to donate $100 each to reach our goal. That's just $8.33 a month to support the stories we bring you each day. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we make the goal, and I know you'll get us there, I'll host a virtual celebration with the World team and send you an invite as a thank you for your support. Right now, go to theworld.org/give, and from everybody here at The World, thanks very much.
Some young immigrants in the U.S. exhale. A new deal in the Middle East. And in Cuba, a growing wave of activism fueled by people who don't normally make waves.
They're not considered radical, they're well-established, they're cultural icons in Cuba, and they came out in support of the protesters from the movement.
And talk about a tough job, moderating hate speech online.
It's a very brave and scary thing to do.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, a virtual UN summit will take stock of where we're at in combating climate change 5 years after the Paris Climate Agreement. A bright spot, the Biden administration.
Having the US back in the tent is incredibly important to the ambitions that we set ourselves in Paris.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Many young immigrants here in the U.S. are breathing a sigh of relief. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to reinstate DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. It has helped protect hundreds of thousands of young immigrants from deportation since 2012. But this feeling of relief could be short-lived. To talk about that, Juliana Macedo do Nascimento joins me. She's the state and local policy manager for United We Dream, an immigrant rights group in Washington. Juliana, reinstating DACA to its original form is good news for young people who haven't been able to submit an application since 2017, but we don't know how long this window will be open. Why is that?
That's right. It's really great news, but because there are still cases unresolved, especially the one in Texas that's coming up for a hearing on December 22nd, we don't know how long DACA will remain open, right? This case in Texas is about nine states that have come together with Texas leading, challenging the United States government on the Administrative Procedures Act and on constitutionality of the program. This will be new, and if Judge Andrew Hanen decides against the program, then DACA can be closed. And we don't know when that will happen, right? The hearing is on the 22nd, but we don't know when the decision will come out anytime after that.
So is the issue that the federal government can't make DACA permanent as long as there's any kind of state level lawsuits going on about it?
The program itself has always been very precarious, right? It's always been temporary. It's every 2 years you have to apply for renewal. And because it was not an executive order, but it was basically just a memo from the executive branch, from the DHS secretary at the time, it could always have been taken away from different administrations as well as be challenged in the court.
How many people do you estimate can now apply for DACA with this kind of reprieve?
Since initial applications was taken away in 2017, right, we estimate that over 300,000 young folks have come of age and become eligible to apply. Not to mention, when DACA first started, the expectation was that over 1.5 million people were eligible. But at the height of the program, we only had over a bit over 800,000 in the program itself. So we know that there are hundreds of thousands of people out there who are eligible and haven't applied yet. So we're trying to reach as many of them as possible.
Who are these new first-time applicants? Are you able to share any anecdotes about them?
I am based in D.C., and we have members here in the DMV area, you know, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, who are high schoolers. They're just very excited to be able to apply. one of the big things about this program is that if you are able to apply before you're 18, then you don't start accruing unlawful presence in the country, right? Which makes it easier for folks to be eligible later on to any kind of status adjustment and become have full legal status, which DACA doesn't provide itself, but it does help that way. So it's really important that younger folks also apply for the program because of that.
What has the incoming Biden administration said about DACA?
They had promised to reinstate the program, right? This was before this latest order, but they haven't really spoken about what they'll do if, you know, the Texas case comes out in a negative decision. What we want them to do is to make sure that even if DACA is taken away, right, that they find other ways to protect people through executive order and executive action, but also to really fight for immigration reform bill in Congress that will protect people without hurting people.
Juliana Macedo do Nascimento is with United We Dream, an immigrant rights group in Washington, D.C. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In the final weeks of Donald Trump's time in the White House, he's kept the presidential pen close at hand. This week, he used it to proclaim Human Rights Week. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, this could turn out to be the final salvo in the Trump administration's campaign to redefine what global human rights means.
Trump's proclamation this week praises the U.S. founding fathers for enshrining human rights and sharing them with the international community. Even though plenty of people had talked about human rights before them, says Lauren Turek. She's a foreign relations historian at Trinity University in Texas.
A lot of these were not new ideas, but the founders put them into their founding documents, and now the United States has this responsibility to, from their perspective, promote those core constitutional values of the United States everywhere.
Turek just published a book about evangelical influence on human rights and U.S. foreign relations, and she says this view of the American founders as instrumental in bringing human rights to the world, it inspired a key group of white evangelical conservatives decades ago.
In the late 60s and early 70s, evangelicals are pretty worried about what they're seeing happening in the world, which is that there is a huge population boom in the global south. So in countries in Africa, in Asia, in the, you know, the Middle East and elsewhere. And those were countries that were not predominantly Christian.
She says this group saw it as their duty to spread the gospel to those places, and they wanted the U.S. to make sure the people there had the right to convert. In the 1990s, conservative evangelicals lobbied to pass the International Religious Freedom Act. It set up an office in the State Department to work specifically on religious freedom.
They really see this as a humanitarian cause because all of these billions of people in the world haven't had the opportunity to be saved. So to them, it's sort of like, how can you even have free speech? How can you have a free press if you don't have freedom of conscience?
Critics say that, acting on this thinking, the Trump administration has tried to divide human rights into two categories. One category is unalienable. Those are the rights bestowed by God and named in the U.S. Constitution, like freedom of religion. The other category is man-made. Those are the human rights that have been recognized by governments and international treaties in the last 70 years, like LGBTQ and reproductive rights. International relations and human rights professor Kurt Mills says those man-made rights have always been the subject of debate. He's at the University of Dundee in Scotland.
There's always been pushback, and I think there will continue to be pushback. It just happened to be the case that the Trump administration took that pushback and ran with it.
In particular, Mills says, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, himself an evangelical Christian, ran with it. Pompeo set up a commission that looked at which human rights should be considered unalienable in U.S. foreign policy.
As human rights claims have proliferated, some claims have come into tension with one another, provoking questions and clashes about which rights are entitled to gain respect.
Critics say the commission's report supports the view that there's a hierarchy of human rights, with freedom of religion at the top, providing justification for Trump administration policies that limit women's rights. Kurt Mills says the U.S. has also set a precedent for other nations to define human rights on their own terms.
The fact that Trump was not reelected means that a lot of these ideas are going to go underground to a certain extent, but they're still going to be out there. And they're still going to allow people who have this agenda of narrowing human rights to keep throwing these arguments out and provide at least pseudo-intellectual support for their arguments.
Pompeo also raised the profile of religious rights by partnering with faith organizations, holding annual ministerials to advance religious freedom, creating an international religious freedom alliance, and training foreign service officers on religious freedom issues. Randy Thompson at the University of Washington in Seattle studies how American religion interacts with U.S. foreign policy.
Pompeo has really institutionalized the pursuit of religious freedom as part of U.S. foreign policy by elevating the International Religious Freedom Office in the State Department and then holding these really high-profile events that have made it clearer to allies that this is a real way to court favor with the United States in ways that I think are going to be lasting.
A year from now, President-elect Joe Biden will be the one issuing a proclamation for Human Rights Week. Activists who want to see a broader range of human rights honored equally hope he'll do more than simply undo what the Trump administration did, says Akhila Radhakrishnan at the Global Justice Center.
With the flick of a pen, there are certain things that Biden can do, but I don't know that it will address what allowed some of this to happen in the first place.
She says if previous U.S. administrations and the founding fathers had done more to live up to the human rights obligations they espoused, we wouldn't still be debating the question of which human rights should be honored. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Here's a thankless job, being an online content moderator. They sift through graphic video, hate speech, and other problematic content on social media and decide what needs to be scrubbed. The vast majority are contractors who are now beginning to organize and demand better working conditions. Here's The World's Lydia Amanalidou with the story.
The content moderators who spoke to us for this story are based in Europe. They're under really strict NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, and could lose their jobs or face legal action for talking about their work. So they asked us not to use their real names, their precise location, or sound from interviews we did with them. What you'll hear is voiceovers of what they told us. One of them, we'll call her Julia, moderates content for Instagram, a photo and video app owned by Facebook. When an Instagram user or one of the platform's automated tools flags a post for potentially violating the rules, that post might end up on Julia's computer screen for review. Some of what she has to look at is really graphic.
Suicide, self-harm. You kind of get used to it, but it can be really challenging. We have some private coping mechanisms, but they don't always work.
Content moderators work for third-party outsourcing companies, and those companies, they say, don't provide mental health screenings, proper training, or adequate support on the job.
The culture of secrecy also creates a lot of pressure.
As content moderators like Julia continue to work in the shadows, they're beginning to quietly organize. Hundreds recently signed and sent an anonymous letter to Facebook's top leadership. They demanded better psychological and psychiatric support on the job and better protections during the pandemic. They also said that they want to be employed directly by the platforms that they help keep safe. Thomas, who's a content moderator for Facebook in Europe, says getting the word out about the letter wasn't easy.
Even organizing signatures for this open letter, it was really tricky. Sending this to any colleagues was already a breach of the NDA.
Finding and connecting with content moderators in other parts of the world was also a challenge. Many of these people can't even tell their own families the work they do, let alone advertise it on social media for others to find them. This is where a London-based nonprofit called Foxglove comes in. They've helped former content moderators launch a lawsuit in Europe, and now they're helping current moderators connect with one another and fight for change.
It's a very brave and scary thing to do.
Martha Dark is one of the founders of Foxglove. She says every week her organization gets more and more emails from content moderators who want to get in touch with their peers in other parts of the world. They have a lot to lose.
Many of the workers that we're talking about, particularly in Europe, are migrant workers whose ability to stay in the country that they're in depends on them keeping their job.
She says for years this global workforce has been siloed, but now there's momentum to change that. Thomas, the content moderator in Europe, agrees, and he's looking at peers at other global companies as a model for where moderators could go next.
Amazon workers are the greatest inspiration.
Amazon warehouse workers, along with activists and union leaders, have formed a powerful global network, a coalition. On Black Friday last month, They helped stage a day of protests in more than a dozen countries.
We are a global workforce, and so we also have to organize globally.
So far, Thomas says, they've been able to establish a line of communication between workers in Europe and the US.
Content moderation is done in Kenya, in India, Malaysia, in the Philippines, in some South American countries. So there's a lot of work to do in reaching out to people there and also bringing them in.
He says the next step will be finding their common challenges and what they can all do about them together. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. The pandemic has upended a lot of plans this year, including a UN summit that was supposed to happen in Glasgow this month, where countries were expected to announce ambitious new targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade. It was postponed a year. The UN and partner countries are instead hosting an online event tomorrow to mark the fifth anniversary of the Paris Agreement. It's designed to nudge countries to make big announcements this year anyway. I'm joined by Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, Amina Mohammed. Deputy Secretary General Mohammed, what is the UN hoping will happen at this virtual summit tomorrow?
Tomorrow is very special because it does mark 5 years since the Paris Agreement came into effect. And what it is doing is taking stock of where we are with those targets that we've set for net zero, on public financing, on the efforts that have been made within our nationally determined contributions, which our commitments by each country. Heads of state and government will be putting commitments where they've improved on them. This summit tomorrow is not just about commemorating Paris plus five, but saying, what have you actually done?
Now, there's been a fear this year that because of the pandemic, work to limit the impacts of global warming through the Paris process will essentially be shelved for a year. Is it looking like that's going to be the case, or does the pandemic actually provide the opportunity for kind of reset with stimulus funding and a temporary dip in emissions?
Well, the pandemic clearly was an enormous health crisis, but it was an even bigger socioeconomic one. And I think everyone had the time to pause. And as we paused, we reflected on how we could take the opportunity from this crisis. And so looking at these stimulus packages that countries have put forward, how to look at a response that would help us in the recovery to green from now. So for instance, to look at what an energy transition would look like, moving from fossil fuels to solar power, for instance. This has been quite exciting because we've seen a lot of forward leaning from business, from governments, particularly at the subnational level. Our cities and our governors across the world have been stepping up. So the possibilities are there. Clearly, we still have challenges when it comes to financing the climate agenda. But I think once we understand that financing elements of the climate agenda will lift the sustainable development agenda, and therefore we're taking all of it together, but just using perhaps the climate investments to accelerate what we need to do towards a 1.5-degree world.
You mentioned jobs, and a lot of people see economic development and work to limit greenhouse gas pollution as opposing goals. But I know you see them as going hand in hand. Why?
As we see it now, what we have to do is to make clear that it's not taking away, it's actually adding value to our lives, to the sustainability of the planet, and as we said, to livelihoods and jobs, which are incredibly important.
You were one of the few senior officials at the UN who spent part of last year traveling. And I know you went to your home country of Nigeria and around West Africa and the Sahel. Did you see the effects of climate change during your travels?
Absolutely, I did. I was only there 3 weeks ago. I was in Nigeria, Niger, Mali, Sierra Leone, and Ghana. And in each case, it was evident. In Northeast Nigeria, climate change has been, of course, exacerbated by conflict. There are millions of people that have been displaced. We've seen the drying up of Lake Chad, which fed over 40 million people in terms of the fish industry that was there, but also the farming industry that was there. And all that has gone away. It has opened up this huge gap where it has been occupied by terrorism. So, I mean, climate really is a problem for many, many issues. In each case, we also saw opportunities. In each case, we saw there are the investments that could be made to bring an end to climate change as we see it on the ground.
Are you from a part of Nigeria that's directly experiencing the impact of climate change?
Yes, I am. I come from the northeast of Nigeria. I went to school in Maiduguri, but I actually come from Gombe. And in both cases, you can see you wake up one day, farmlands are wiped out by the desert and climate change. That's a very real happening in the lives of my extended family and many people in that region.
We're speaking with Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, Amina Mohammed, about tomorrow's virtual summit on climate change. In 2009, rich nations agreed to provide poorer ones $100 billion in funding a year by 2020 to combat climate change. It doesn't look like the world has quite gotten there. How does the UN hope to close this gap?
We are proposing to close the gap by continue to advocate that public finance and private finance needed to come together this year. We actually saw good trends in 2018, 2019, but we will not have met the target by 2020. And it has been, to a degree, exacerbated by COVID. What we're hoping this summit will do is, again, put pressure and put fire under the feet of those leaders that need to bring those resources to the table.
Now, outgoing President Trump removed the U.S. from the Paris Agreement. President-elect Joe Biden has said on day one in office he plans to rejoin the Paris Agreement. He won't be at tomorrow's virtual summit, but do you think the change in the U.S. administration is having an influence on how other leaders are approaching the meeting?
Well, the U.S. leadership has always been an integral part of the success of the Paris Agreement. They were there in Paris in 2015 to make it happen. Having the U.S. back in the tent is incredibly important to the ambitions that we set ourselves in Paris, and they seem much nearer now than they did perhaps a year or two ago. And so we very much look forward to it.
Do you have your sights on a few different countries who are going to be at the virtual meeting tomorrow to kind of step forward and make any big announcements?
Well, we are. I mean, we've seen the UK, of course, will be there making their announcements. We expect that already announcements from Japan, Korea. We have a list of countries which are now, of course, up for everyone to see on our website. So we had hoped for more, but we do see, good trends coming from countries like India that have been very forward-leaning on the solar side, the energy transitions. This really is a curtain raiser to that road to COP26. What we say here will give us indications of the road we have to travel and the gaps and the ambition that we will have to raise as we start out in 2021.
Amina Mohammed is the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations. She's been speaking to me from UN headquarters in New York. I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also today, the latest news on what becoming a world of homebodies has done for the global climate. A new tally out today, the most complete one yet, finds greenhouse gas pollution is down 7% for the year. That's according to a report from the Global Carbon Project, a group of dozens of international scientists who track emissions. They say the drop is mostly because people are simply staying home, traveling less by cars and planes. Here in the U.S., emissions of planet-warming greenhouse gases fell by a lot, 12%. In China, the drop was just under 2%. That's partly because China is still operating closer to normal times. An aggressive early lockdown there helped limit the spread of the virus and kept the wheels of Chinese society spinning. When this pandemic finally ends, global carbon emissions are expected to jump up again. Still, officials say it's possible that carbon pollution hit its peak in 2019 and may start to head on a downward trajectory. If you need a recommendation for your weekend listening, here's one. We recently had a conversation with Harvard epidemiologist Megan Murray. She talks about the latest surge in coronavirus cases around the world and the impact of it all. We've turned that conversation into a podcast. Listen and download now on your favorite podcast app or at theworld.org. And this is The World.
A reminder to our listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to bring you human-centered journalism that connects you with people and events beyond our borders. During this holiday season, when many of us can't meet in person, that human connection is more important than ever. Help us keep the show available to everybody across the globe with your gift of $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we reach our goal, you'll get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. If you've considered donating but haven't actually done it yet, then today is a day to take intention and turn it into action, one we at the show will be deeply grateful for. Just head to theworld.org/give. Thank you.
A kid in Africa loves a song by Sting. The The kid grows up, becomes a musician, and reworks Sting's song with an African twist. Then Sting takes a listen.
Man, he loves it. He said it made him smile in the time where he felt like that's what we need. He felt like, you know, it was a special version.
The updated version of Sting's Englishman in New York, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. After decades of keeping their diplomatic distance, Israel and Morocco will move toward normalizing relations. The Trump administration helped broker the deal, and it announced that the U.S. will now recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara. I spoke earlier with Eric Goldstein from Human Rights Watch and asked him about the region.
It's an area the size of Colorado between Morocco and Mauritania on the northwest coast of Africa. It was a Spanish colony, and after Morocco obtained independence in the 1950s, it began making claims over Western Sahara. And in the 1970s, they appealed to the International Court of Justice. The court ruled that Morocco's ties to Western Sahara did not amount to ties of sovereignty, and that the people of this Spanish colony were entitled to self-determination. Morocco moved in 350,000 Moroccan civilians in what is called the Green March, and then went on to militarily occupy the Western Sahara, or most of it, because the Spanish withdrew and the Polisario Front, which is the independence movement of the Sahrawi people, went to war with Morocco, a war that lasted until a UN-brokered ceasefire in 1991 that has remained in effect until very recently.
And the Polisario, this is sort of a rebel front that wants independence for Western Sahara. What are their goals and who do they represent?
The Polisario Front is recognized by the UN as the representative of the Sahrawi people. They are calling for a vote of self-determination, where the Sahrawis in the Western Sahara can vote whether to achieve independence or some kind of federation or incorporation into the Kingdom of Morocco. They are based in exile in Algeria.
So this kind of presents a problem for the incoming Biden administration in many ways, because the Western Sahara, its fate has been determined before Joe Biden takes office. What problem does it leave the Biden administration in?
This is one of several mines that the Trump administration is leaving for the Biden administration. It's kind of a fire sale during the lame duck period. And it is a problem. It would be very hard for President Biden to cancel this recognition, since it's tied in with a deal made between Morocco and Israel. And I doubt Biden would want to pay the political capital of threatening that deal. But there are things that the Biden administration could do to make it harder at the UN for Morocco, and things they could do to make it easier. It's a disappointment that there were no concessions extracted from Morocco on the Western Sahara in this deal, which is basically a police state operated by Morocco. There is no freedom of expression or association for people there who support self-determination. The whole deal was made on the back of the Sahrawi people, and the Biden can walk some of that back, I think.
Eric Goldstein is Human Rights Watch Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Officers from the DEA and other American police agencies have worked in Mexico for decades. They're there to help their Mexican counterparts fight organized crime. But this week, the president of Mexico began to express concern about this American presence in his country. Here's The World's Jorge Valencia from Mexico City.
It's not just the Drug Enforcement Administration that has offices here. It's also the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Customs and Border Patrol, several others. Now, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is saying Mexico should have a better idea of what they're doing here. Most legislators agree.
Este dictamen que se discute,
Senator Ricardo Monreal presented a bill before the Senate this week. He's one of the president's closest allies in Congress. And he says this is a matter of national security.
Hoy la DEA tiene en México 11 oficinas.
Monreal says the DEA has 11 offices in Mexico, but the Mexican government does not know how many agents are in the country or what kind of information they're collecting.
Pongamos fin a 100 años de violación a nuestra soberanía.
Let's end 100 years of violation of our sovereignty, Monreal says. The legislation requires foreign agents to submit regular reports to the Mexican government, and it requires them to hand over any intelligence they gather here. This bill is very likely a response to the DEA's recent arrest in Los Angeles of a former Mexican defense minister, says Alejandro Hope, a security analyst based in Mexico City.
No one is saying that, but that is pretty clear.
Hope says military leaders here were none too pleased when General Salvador Cienfuegos was arrested and charged with drug trafficking.
My guess is the armed forces might be among the supporters of this as a way of getting back at the U.S. for having an investigation on a Mexican official without telling Mexico.
In fact, Hope says this is a sign of the political influence the Mexican military has accumulated over 14 years of war against drug traffickers. Former Defense Minister General Cienfuegos was eventually returned to Mexico at the Mexican government's urging. He faces no charges here.
And this is confirmation of what we saw in the Cienfuegos case, that they can sway policy in very important ways.
Hope says the restrictions may backfire because the DEA regularly infiltrates organized crime here and already hands over intelligence. Hope says the largest network of informants in Mexico is managed by the DEA.
They are very aggressive at recruiting informants. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of experience. They have a lot of agents. They have a lot of technology. And that's only part of the equation. Then there's also access to intercepts, access to drones.
So Mexico is shooting itself in the foot.
Mike Vigil used to head international operations for the DEA.
And I worked in Mexico for a total of 13 years.
Vigil says Mexican law enforcement's major victories have often been assisted by American investigations.
The Mexican government has been able to accomplish a lot of things in terms of its counter-drug efforts, such as the capture of major capos, you know, like the Chapo Guzman, and then a lot of the seizures that take place in Mexico occur as a result of the efforts of DEA.
But Vigil says his biggest concern isn't about having to hand over intelligence. He says it's the new requirement that any Mexican official who speaks with a foreign agent must submit a written report.
Nobody is going to take DEA's calls because they're not going to want to write a report each and every time that they talk to the DEA.
So Vigil says law enforcement cooperation between Mexico and the U.S. appears to be entering a new chapter. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
In Cuba, people are getting more and more fed up with rules and regulations. The internet is helping fuel that. The most recent groups to voice their dissent, rappers, musicians, and young Cubans. The Cuban government has noticed and is clamping down. Roseanne Lake is the Cuba correspondent for The Economist magazine. You're about to hear her speak with Jason Palmer of the Intelligence Podcast, brought to us by our friends at Economist Radio. The demonstration she describes took place on November 27th in Havana, where nearly 300 people gathered outside the culture ministry.
Protests or gatherings of that size are simply not tolerated. It was also a very long event. It started early in the day and ended early the next morning at around 2 a.m.
And so what prompted people to take that risk, to go out and assemble in those kinds of numbers?
Something else somewhat unprecedented. On November 26th, there was a raid on an apartment in San Isidro, which is a poor neighborhood of Havana. And it was something of a violent raid. So using the pretext that one of the people inside of this apartment had flouted a COVID-19 quarantine regulation, agents dressed in medical gowns broke down the door and they arrested the 14 people inside. Now, most of these people had been inside the apartment for about 8 days, and a few of them were on a hunger and thirst strike in protest of the arrest of a young rapper named Denis Solis, who had been imprisoned and is still in prison because he was accused of disrespecting authority. And this movement took place inside this apartment is part of a wider protest movement known as the Movimiento San Isidro, so named after the neighborhood where these 14 people were. And it's basically a motley collective that includes artists, academics, journalists, rappers, dissident poets, and even some scientists who are advocating for freedom of expression and democratic values, which obviously in Cuba can be complicated.
muchas historias que llegaron a su fin, mucha gente ruin, muchas flores muertas en mi jardín, nadie me enseñó.
It is telling that outside of the ministry that day, you had very prominent Cuban artists, and they came out in defense of the people gathered there. They're not considered radical, they're well established, they're cultural icons in Cuba, and they came out in support of the protesters from the movement. So it's sort of been taken to another level. And if you speak to people like Carlos Manuel Alvarez, he was one of those detained from the raid at the apartment in San Isidro. His view on the situation is that there are signs of an emerging collective unconformity in Cuba, which I thought was very interesting. And he said that young people with very different ideas gathered that day in front of the ministry, many of them not even knowing why they were there, but they just felt the need to go. This was his way of expressing that this was possibly Cuba's first step in developing what might eventually be a civic culture.
That was Roseanne Lake of The Economist. You can hear more of her reporting about the explosion of Cuban activism at The Economist Radio's The Intelligence podcast. In hospitals everywhere, medical staffs have made a lot of adjustments for COVID-19. Here's a group of flexible hospital workers you might not think of much, medical clowns. Their job is to bring smiles and laughs to patients. Their work can reduce anxiety and improve the well-being of people in the hospital. But how do you clown around when you have to keep your distance and cover yourself in protective gear? The world's Ariel Osaran joined a medical clown in an Israeli hospital and has our story.
For the last 7 years, Leah Weiss has been working as a medical clown at Sha'arei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem. Most of Leah's work is in pediatrics, but when the hospital opened a COVID ward back in March, she knew that the clown in her could help.
So wherever he's needed, that's where he goes. And I felt that we're very needed there.
At first, the experience was overwhelming, Leah says. But very quickly, her clown persona, Rosie, knew what to do.
So obviously the doctors, they take care of the body. And we come and we take care of the soul. And it integrates together. And the doctors understand that. Okay, so first thing, we put on the jumpsuit.
That's the standard white suit all medical personnel use in such wards. Then we put on shoe covers, N95 face masks, a face shield, and two sets of surgical gloves, taped sealed at the wrist. After going through remotely activated double doors, we enter the ward.
Now we're still dressed up, but we're not dressed up as clowns. So that's our next stop, to go get our things, because our things are inside.
In times of COVID, medical clowns have to work extra hard to stand out. That's because all of the medical staff looks the same in these hazmat suits. So Leah takes me to the back of the ward where there's a box written Rosie's Corner on it.
So here, I have my tutu, colorful tutu, that I made on my own. Very proud of myself. And then I have a hat with a pink pompon on it.
Next, Leah pulls out a blue plastic tiara and places it over her hat. And of course, the medical clown's trademark.
We also have our red noses that we put on top of the plastic mask.
Israel is considered a world leader in medical clowning. The first school ever to offer a full undergrad program in medical clowning was Haifa University. Leah is one of more than 100 medical clowns working in Israeli hospitals today. Here, they're considered part of the medical staff. Once she's all prepared, Leah, or should I now say Rosie, starts making her rounds. Rosie speaks four languages, including a bit of Arabic. Rosie walks up to a patient in her 60s. She's sitting on her bed wearing regular clothes. How are you? Rosie asks. Don't worry, you'll be out in a day or two.
Wow!
She's going out today?
She's going out today, yes. I met her last time, and she was tired and weak, and it's great news. It's happy.
As Rosie makes her rounds, patients raise their heads and smile at her. They're all happy to see her. Further into the ward, there's a rush of doctors and nurses moving from patient to patient. Rosie and a fellow clown try hard to help everyone in the ward relax. And sometimes the staff play along. As Rosie arrives at the bed of Avraham, one of the patients, the attending doctor jokes that Avraham was worried when he heard that clowns were let into the ward. You got nervous? Rosie asks. Yes, the man replies while laughing. Well, how do I look then? Rosie asks and begins to spin around in her tutu. As the shift continues, Rosie and the other clown pull out a portable speaker and play songs for the patients. For a brief moment, the harmony of beeping machines and coughing patients is interrupted by music.
We're getting the party started.
Rosie and the other clown break out and dance, spinning around in full protective gear. And of course, the red noses. When Rosie meets patients who are severely sick, her demeanor changes. The jokes are put aside to make room for compassion and kindness. Most of the patients in the ward are in their 60s or 70s, and some of them suffer from dementia. Rosie says that many of these patients don't know where they are. They're confused and frightened.
And when I start talking to them, I see sometimes they just look at me and then tears start to come down. It breaks my heart. Nothing you could do. I mean, just make them comfortable and make them confident at the same moment.
Rosie says that rather than focusing on the patient's condition, often she'll try to make a simple human connection. At one point, a nurse asks Rosie to meet Ben.
Shalom, Ben. Ma shlomcha? Boker tov.
He's 32 years old and has been in a vegetative state for some time. And recently, he contracted COVID-19. Two photos of Ben are taped to the wall near his bed. In them, he looks lively and cheerful. But now, he's only able to blink. Rosie gently introduces herself and asks Ben how he's doing. His eyes are wide open, looking at her. As one of the nurses takes a sample of blood from Ben's arm, Rosie places a phone near his ear. She plays Ben a song by Israeli singer Yuval Dayan. Shirak techayech, may you always smile, she sings. That's all I ask for. Lea says that in these difficult times, having Rosie in her life has saved her. She says that Rosie always reminds her that the most important thing to do right now is to just keep on smiling. For the world, I'm Ariel Osaran in Jerusalem.
At long last, we've had some good news this week about the coronavirus. Vaccines are ready and people are starting to get inoculated. On Tuesday, a British nurse rolled up the sleeve of 90-year-old Margaret Keenan and administered what's been called the shot watched round the world. Keenan was given the first Pfizer vaccine outside of a clinical trial.
At the moment, I don't know how I feel. It's just so strange and so wonderful, really.
As for here in the U.S., millions of vaccine doses should be available within a matter of days, but it will take many, many months to protect communities. In the meantime, the virus is devastating the U.S. and much of the world. The latest tallies, roughly 1.6 million people have died from COVID-19 worldwide, and close to 300,000 are dead in the U.S. Each day in the U.S., around 3,000 people are now dying from the disease. More people died on Wednesday than during the September 11th terror attacks. That's why health and environment specialists like Joe Allen at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health have this message: wash hands, wear a mask, keep your distance, and also...
You want to increase the amount of fresh air coming into your school, home, or office. Two, put in better filters on the recirculated air.
Allen says the evidence from around the world has made it clear. Improving air ventilation and filtration is vital in reducing the spread of COVID-19. Consider the example of smoking. If you're 3 feet away from a smoker, you're going to inhale a lot of smoke. 6 feet away, less so.
It's really about shared air. So whose air are you breathing? Respiratory particles, the same way. They actually move through the air in a lot of the same ways. And they're cleaned out of the air in the same ways.
Or consider a recent case study from South Korea. Two people 20 feet apart were in a restaurant with no windows for just 5 minutes. The coronavirus was passed between them.
All of the high-profile case studies that I think many people be familiar with now, outbreak at a choir practice, at a salon, ice hockey, on a school bus, it doesn't really matter where it was. It's the underlying factors, and they're actually all the same. It's time indoors, no masks, and low to no ventilation.
Quick tip, when you're indoors with others, open a window. It helps. To hear more from Harvard's Joe Allen about the importance of indoor ventilation, we've posted a video of the World's Facebook Live conversation with him on our website, theworld.org. Now let's wrap up the week with a story about imagining a dream scenario and then making it happen. Here's my colleague, Marco Werman.
Paulo Prudencio was just a kid growing up in the West African country of Benin when his music-loving mom played him this song at their home. I'm an Englishman in New York. Fast forward to today, Paulo has taken the stage name Shirazi. He's living in the Bronx. Inspired by Sting's 1988 hit, Shirazi began composing in his head African in New York with the blessing of Sting. I'm an African in New York. You didn't see I'm from my pride and energy. When I didn't walk out down the street, you can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Shirazi said Sting's reaction to his version was exactly what he was hoping for.
Well, man, he loves it. He said that it made him smile in the time where he felt like that's what we need. He felt like, you know, it was a special version. And it's just very mind-boggling to me to go from, you know, discovering it, you know, as a kid and now being able to even, you know, be in a conversation of just exchanging with him about it is just incredible. And I'm glad people are actually reacting the same actually to the record. So it's pretty cool if you ask me. I'm an alien. I'm a legal alien. I'm an African in New
York. The opening line, Shirazi, to your version, African in New York, goes, every day I wake up, here's a win, because I got here on a dream. I still hear my mother praying every day. I'm an African in New York. Is that, in fact, your own story? What brought you to New York?
Exactly that. It's like the dream. The dream is what I feel like brought me to New York, because being talented is one thing, but being able to compete on a high level is another with the music. And I thought if I was able to do it here, you know, I know it sounds cliche, but there's something very real about that. And so, yeah, it was a dream. The dream brought me to New York. And when I say every day I wake up here is a win, it's real because I know where I'm from, right? And I know that if I was in Benin right now, chances of me being able to make the same record and be heard on this level and cutting through to Sting would not be that easy, right? So I just really understand what it means to be here and be able to do this for a living.
Well, as you point out, I mean, for some immigrants, those dreams have not been realized. You must have seen some of those challenges in New York. In your song, you romanticize New York City a little bit, but is there still struggle and disparity in it?
Oh, for sure. I feel like there's still struggle and disparity in anything, in anywhere you are in the world. I think there's still going to be some struggle, you know. But it's about how you take that struggle and turn it into something positive. And when you hear me, when you hear that voice, when you hear everything I've been through, it's just interesting to be, you know, to go from homeless, right, in the same city and to be talking about recording a song like African in New York and being in a conversation with a legend and him telling you, man, your version is amazing. And so it's just about you, the way you see things and the way you turn that struggle into something.
Were you homeless at one point?
Yes, I was. I was. It took people like my landlady, who's still my landlady to this day, by the way. She saw something in me and she said, you know, you're like my son. I cannot leave you out there in the cold. So back to your struggle and adversity question. It's like, you know, she has 6 kids and she's married. And to give some kid from Benin a place to stay for 8 months, I mean, you can imagine what it does to her, because she needs the money as well. And so for her to see something in me enough to go, you know what, I'm going to just trust the process and see where this kid goes. I mean, it's just incredible. That's just a New York story right there.
That is a beautiful New York story. Beninois musician Shirazi speaking with us from the Bronx. He's the man behind African in New York, a different take on the song by Sting. Shirazi, thank you very much.
You're most welcome, sir.
And check out Shirazi's very cool video for African in New York, which could only be shot on location in the Bronx. You can see that at theworld.org. And that's all for this week. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.